It is 8:29, and we have with us live in the studios, as we do just about every week, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, well, let's start things out here with the developments here at the local level, and Dino Rossi in doing a deposition this week.
Yeah, we talked about this last week, where the lawsuit that's been filed by Faith Ireland and Bob Butter, a couple of former Washington State Supreme Court justices, accusing Rossi of illegal use of campaign funds on a really unprecedented scale in Washington State. And what this is the Building Industry Association of Washington, the arch conservative special interest group that, among other things, has compared environmentalists to Nazis, is clearly one of Rossi's biggest supporters, and was also in 2004. But because it's an independent group, it's not supposed to coordinate fundraising with Dino Rossi's campaign. Well, apparently Rossi himself was caught in the minutes of one of the BIAW's local affiliates, the Master Builders Association of King and Snohomish Counties. The minutes of the Master Builders Association meeting showed that several board members had been called personally by Rossi to get the MBA to kick in money for BIAW's quote fund for Dino. And Rossi's defense for this was, well, I wasn't a declared candidate at the time, but that's not actually how the law reads. The law says that you have to start reporting this stuff, and you have to start adhering by campaign rules as soon as you start raising money or otherwise preparing for a run. It's not a question of when you make a public declaration. Otherwise, you could publicly declare 3 days before, you know, the filing deadline, and use all the rest of the time to raise your money illegally. It would make a mockery of the laws. Well, a judge ruled at the beginning of the week that when Rossi refused to make a deposition in the case, which the plaintiffs had requested, that he in fact had to do so, and that information had to get out to the public in time to make a decision on the election. And of course, the election ballots had already gone out, and people have been voting for the last week and a half. Well, Rossi did testify on Wednesday. The plaintiff's attorney, Noel Lowry, characterized it, and I'm paraphrasing here, as one of the least cooperative witnesses he'd ever had. Rossi was evasive. He disrespectful to the judge and to the attorneys, and for his part, Rossi basically called the whole thing a politically motivated smear job. But again, his defense is that he wasn't a declared candidate, and that defense is simply laughable. So, and we also found out that from Rossi's testimony that the coordination went much deeper than anybody had realized. That it wasn't just phone calls; he was taking people out to lunch. He was hitting them up specifically, money specifically for Dino Rossi. And if you're raising money from political action committees, you know, usually that's because you're a candidate. It's not just because you're an average citizen that, you know, if Maria or I wanted to go to the Masters Builders Association and ask them to cut us a check for a few tens of thousands of dollars, you know, just for the heck of it, I doubt they would. But because Rossi was a candidate is why they're having the conversation at all, very clearly. So the question is whether anything can be done about this before the election, because that illegally raised money is exactly the money that's being used by the Rossi campaign to absolutely flood the airwaves with television and radio commercials. And those commercials could very well make the difference in a close election. Excuse me, between Rossi or Gregoire being our next governor. So if Rossi gets elected after Tuesday, you know, what's the penalty? Why wouldn't that have been a worthwhile cost of doing business? So really, the only recourse we have to trying to address a really fairly grievous and intentional violation of the campaign finance laws is to get the information out to the public and say the public shouldn't reward this kind of behavior by electing Dino Rossi, our next governor, who should vote for Christine Gregoire.
All right. And developments in the 46th.
Yeah, the very closely contested state legislative race between two Democrats, Scott White and Jerry Paulette, took an interesting turn this week. White is sort of the establishment Democratic candidate. He's also taken money from the BIAW. He also tried to withdraw from the race at one point and then changed his mind and jumped back in after the filing deadline, but that's a whole other story. But it turns out this week also that White, who is a city employee, or a public employee, has been illegally using his computer and his work time to coordinate his campaign, which is a big no-no, and which at the same time, when investigators came and asked him about it, he said, "Oh, those were just files that were accidentally downloaded into our work computer," which again is kind of a preposterous defense. So not only did he violate the campaign rules, but then he lied about it to investigators under oath. So this is again something where, well, what's the redress for this? Well, if he wins, if there's some kind of a fine afterwards, it pales compared to the fact that he just won a state legislative seat in a district where, realistically speaking, he can have that seat for as long as he wants it, especially since he has the backing of the local Democratic Party infrastructure. The only recourse that voters have to that at this late point in the voting process is to vote for his opponent, Jerry Paulette, and saying, who is, in my opinion, the better candidate anyway, but to vote for Paulette and to say, we're not going to reward this kind of campaign behavior with essentially a lifetime sinecure in a very safe Democratic seat in the 46th district.
All right. Moving on to national, and Ted Stevens having his day in court.
Yeah, speaking of, we haven't done police blotter in a while, but I thought we should bring it back for a special campaign edition, because in addition to Rossi and to Scott White, we had the national spectacle this week of Ted Stevens being convicted on 7 felony counts of essentially lying to investigators. And again, Stevens, who is sort of not only one of the founders but the patron saint of what up in Alaska they very proudly called the Corrupt Bastards Club. Well, surprise, surprise, he's a corrupt bastard. this will come as a shock. A shock, I tell you. Stevens was convicted on all 7 counts, and his defense to all this was, these well-connected lobbyists and oil executive friends gave me gifts that were worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, sure, but I didn't even realize that they'd given me gifts. I had no idea that they had or who they were from. And, you know, for a man in his position who entered Congress 40-some years ago as a neophyte politician and is now a multimillionaire, it's easy to understand how you could get confused about all the gifts of worth tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars that you get from your quote-unquote friends. And it's easy to see how you could overlook a few of them.
And his defense that, well, I didn't ask them to do these things and to give these things to me. It's like, hello, that's the nature of a gift. You don't ask for it. It just is given to you.
Yeah.
And the giver... In this case, the giver may ask for something in return. That's the whole point behind banning gifts to senators.
It's not a gift. It's an exchange. It's called quid quo pro. And given that Stevens is notorious as one of the legislators in D.C. who is most adamant about pork barrel projects, earmarks, slipping little things into the budget to take care of his friends, you could say those investments were very, very well paid off over the years. So anyway, one of the things that is taken into account in sentencing for these crimes is whether the defendant is repentant or not. And Stevens most definitely is not. He was back in Alaska campaigning for re-election yesterday.
And, you know, I thought there was something, a rule that barred senators who are convicted felons from serving in Congress.
Well, there are, but he hasn't been. He has. That would take effect pending appeal, and he's already said he's going to appeal.
Right. So he could very well be elected, sent to the Senate, and be a convicted felon at the same time.
And not only that, but if his appeals fail, and you know the
then
nature of these,
then it opens a whole can of worms of how do you replace him.
Well, you replace him with a special election.
Yeah.
But he is our Mitch McConnell,
which
who's
will
the Senate minority.
The taxpayers, by
yes.
the way.
Well, not nearly as much as Stevens has already cost them over the years. But Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, has already said there's 100% certainty that Stevens is going to be expelled from the Senate if his conviction holds up, which it almost certainly will. So we are looking at having and Stevens is behind in the polls. And, you know, to be honest, even though he's a widely revered figure up there, I would be astonished if we're going to have Ted Stevens in the Senate come January. And that can only be good news for the rest of the country and for Alaska, by the way. Just think, you could get rid of, well, they'll still have Sarah Palin. That's you know, can't get everything up in Alaska at the same time.
All right. That then takes us on to this week's economic news.
Yeah. I just want to talk for a bit about the bailout bill, as Jav mentioned earlier, that when you pass these things in a hurry, the wording isn't very specific. And in this case, Congress made the wording in the bailout bill so vague that it's allowed the Treasury to use it to use the money for all kinds of different things. I believe the wording just
paying
said,
off friends.
Yeah, just said, let's bail out the housing market, you know, and do what we can to save the financial industry. And so, of course, the Treasury is using that money for all kinds of things. It just the Treasury just released the list of the folks who are going to get the first $125 billion of the bailout money. And what it turns out is that all eight of the biggest banks in the United States took a chunk of that money, whether they actually needed it or not. And those eight banks included banks that have bought out some of the banks that were failing earlier, like J.P. Morgan Chase, for example. They bought out, I believe it was Bear Stearns in February, and then they bought out, not Merrill Lynch, Bank of America bought out Merrill Lynch, but then they bought out Lehman Brothers.
And WaMu.
And or they bought out WaMu. Lehman Brothers was allowed to fail. So, and J.P. Morgan Chase is considered one of the better banks in the U.S. right now, but they took a $25 billion chunk of money from the Treasury.
Expected them to turn it down, maybe?
Yeah, no, that's the thing. J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Citigroup, each took $25 billion from the Treasury. Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, and I'm shocked that Goldman Sachs took anything, because they are probably the best situated investment bank and arguably the best situated bank in the U.S. right now. They took $10 billion each. Bank of New York Mellon took $3 billion. State Street took $2 billion, and on and on and on. So, you know, what are they going to use the money for? Supposedly, the Treasury says, well, they're going to use the money to loan out to businesses and loosen up the credit markets so that money can flow again and people can borrow and spend, et cetera, et cetera. But J.P. Morgan Chase was caught by a New York Times reporter the head of J.P. Morgan Chase was caught telling his employees that, oh, no, we're not going to use the money to increase lending. In fact, we're going to tighten lending because of the nature of the financial situation right now. We're going to tighten our lending. We're going to use this money probably for acquisitions and to buy out banks that are failing. So in essence,
and executive retreats.
Yeah, right. And maybe some stock buybacks, etc. So, and that's true of most of the other banks, because not only did the big banks line up and all take a cut, but a lot of mid-sized regional banks have lined up to take a chunk of the money as well. These mid-sized banks have also said that they're going to use the funds not necessarily to lend out money at a local level, but to buy up other banks. The list is, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase says that they're going to buy out other banks, but PNC Financial, they just announced they were going to acquire National City Corp. They took $7.7 billion from the Treasury in order to assist with that merger. SunTrust took $3.5 billion. They say they're going to use it to make acquisitions. Other banks that will make acquisitions include Regions Financial. They took $3.5 billion from the Treasury for that purpose. BB&T has also said they're going to buy out other banks. They took $3.1 billion from the Treasury. And our very own local Washington Federal said that, oh, yeah, we want this cheap money, man. these other banks are going for you know bargain basement prices. We want to look at acquisitions. So we're taking $200 million from the Treasury to do that. So you know, the interest, one of the I think very interesting things about this is how is that money structured? Now the Treasury said that they're gonna loan out this money to banks, so it's structured as a loan, right? And what they're going to get in exchange is they're going to get preferred stock issued to them in exchange. This is non-voting stock in these banks, which means the Treasury has no control over any of the business decisions that any of these banks have. And that non-voting preferred stock is going to pay a 5% dividend to the Treasury. So in essence, it's a cheap loan. But here's the deal. In 5 years, if the banks don't pay that money back to the Treasury, the dividend on the preferred stock goes up to 9%. So if you look at that, it's structured just like an adjustable rate mortgage. And you might ask, okay, now, is that a good idea? Because generally, you know, some of these banks, sure, they're healthy now, but if the crisis continues, goes on for a year or two or three or four, those banks might not be able to pay that money back. And then you're looking at, in 5 years, the Treasury saying, well, maybe we need to give more money, maybe we need to extend the low interest rates, whatever. It's just like... It's kind of like hooking the banks on an adjustable rate mortgage the same way that Americans were hooked on adjustable rate mortgages.
Isn't that kind of poetic, though?
It is in a way, but it's not going to stabilize the financial system, which is what the whole idea
is. And it's certainly not going to put credit back into the system.
And then the Fed argues, too, that the Fed and the Treasury together argue that it's a good idea that these banks are using this money to buy up distressed banks, because then the FDIC doesn't, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, doesn't have to step in and bail out failing banks, doesn't have to pour taxpayer money into these failed banks. But we're using taxpayer money anyway. If the FDIC stepped in to rescue some of these failed banks, they would pay back depositors up to a certain fairly high limit now, up to the $250,000 limit on deposits, so the depositors would get back their money. Bondholders might get a little bit of money back, too, once the assets of the bank are sold. And then shareholders and company executives, who own huge numbers of stock options, those guys would get nothing, which I think is poetic justice, and that's what ought to happen. That's what happens when the FDIC steps in. But by pouring money into banks in the way the Treasury is doing and encouraging healthy banks to buy out these failed banks, what they're doing is they're rescuing shareholders and they're rescuing these CEOs and executives who made bad decisions and who own a lot of stock options. They're basically, and they're rescuing bondholders. So, and I think that that's not poetic justice. That's just perpetuating
it's
the
theft.
Problem. Yeah, yeah, it's theft and it's perpetuating the problem.
The other interesting thing, I forget where I saw this, but apparently somebody caught an internal memo within Treasury this week where the question was basically, how much of this money can we disperse by on or about January 20th?
Yeah, and
which just happens to be Inauguration Day.
Yeah.
So if you recall 8 years ago when there was this big manufactured hoo-ha about some of the Clinton employees as they were leaving the White House taking the silverware or, you know, messing with the keyboards on computers, now they're not just taking the silverware, they're taking the carpet, the lighting fixtures, they're taking
the
everything.
The cash in the safe, they're taking everything.
They're taking everything they can loot, basically, on their way out
so
the door.
So it makes you wonder if there's going to be much of anything left when Obama becomes president in January. My fingers are crossed. But in addition to what I've already said about problems with pouring money into banks in this way and encouraging mergers, is that now anybody, anywhere in the U.S., any company anywhere in the U.S., is thinking, gosh, if banks can get this kind of a deal, maybe I can get this kind of a deal too. All I would have to do is set up a subsidiary of my company, put all my debts and financing into that subsidiary, call it a financial holding company, and then go to the Fed and say, hey, I need a piece of the bailout package. And in fact, we're starting to see this. GM, General Motors, people may be following the problems in the American auto industry, which gambled for too long on gas-guzzling SUVs. GM has
had a higher profit margin.
Yeah, yeah, right, up until fairly recently. And GM and Chrysler are looking at trying to work a merger in order to save one or both of the companies. In order to do that, they need money from an outside source. They can't get it from banks, which are not loaning for this purpose right now. And so GM is trying to work a deal where they put, like I just described, they put a lot of their debts and a lot of their financing into GMAC, their financing portion of their company. They're trying to spin it off as a financial holding company and trying to get billions from the U.S. Treasury that they can then turn around and use to finance this merger. I think that's a slippery slope.
But if GMAC became a separate entity, how would you transfer the money?
It's not separate now. It's a subsidiary. No, and they're not talking about making it separate. They're talking about making it a subsidiary.
Oh, I see.
So then they can. It's an Enron-style thing.
As opposed to a division, mm-hmm. which is now. Yeah.
right. And in corporate terminology, these things basically boil down to the same thing. It's still connected to GM. GM wants to use that unit. Call it a bank and say it's our bank, pour money into it so then we can use the money for the merger. And there are other companies that are going to try to do this as well. Don't think this is going to end soon. So, and of course the Fed says, well, don't worry because taxpayers will eventually get all this money back. But, you know, when you structure it like an adjustable rate mortgage, there's no guarantee. In addition, the Fed and the Treasury have been taking on additional risk as well. The Fed also started loaning money directly to companies through its commercial paper funding facility. About $144 billion went out this week in short-term cash flow loans to companies in all kinds of industries in the U.S. because the Fed is now doing what banks won't do, which is make short-term cash flow loans to businesses. That's an exposure to a lot of risk that the federal government has never, ever done before. And the Fed as well decided...
But the Fed's not part of the federal government, is it?
Well, it is and it isn't. Sort of like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are and they aren't. Well, and the Fed is also decided this week that they were going to extend credit lines of $30 billion each to the central banks of Brazil, Mexico, South Korea, and Singapore. Again, that's taking on a lot of additional risk to bail out a global financial system. And you might ask, why are we bailing out the global financial system? Well, we are the source of the problem. And when you've got a president who's not looking at dealing with the source of the problem and a Congress which is twiddling its thumbs, then it leaves the Fed and the Treasury to try to deal with the global system rather than dealing with the cause of the problem, which is stabilizing the U.S. housing market.
Okay. Is that it?
Yeah, that's it. We got to move on and talk about some other things.
All right. Moving on to developments at Guantanamo.
Yeah, six Algerians they used to be Algerians about 10 years or so ago, they applied for citizenship in Bosnia, and they received their citizenship in Bosnia. But once the war on terrorism came along, the Bush administration decided that it was going to pick up anybody that they thought were terrorism suspects and stick them in Guantanamo. Well, these six former Algerians, who are now Bosnian citizens, have spent some 6 years in Guantanamo, and this week the terrorism charges against them were dropped by the U.S. government. Also, most of the key evidence against them has been proved to be unreliable. And so these six Algerians are still Algerians, now Bosnian citizens, are still being held in Guantanamo. They are the last of the European citizens who are being held there. And it came out this week that not only have the charges been dropped and the evidence against them is not credible at all, it came out this week that in order to get them and put them in Guantanamo, the U.S. Government made threats to the NATO coalition in Bosnia, saying, "We will pull out of the coalition unless you surrender these guys to us."
And these guys had actually been put on trial in Bosnia.
That's right. A Bosnian court had declared the evidence against them insufficient and that they should be released. And yet the U.S. government put pressure on the Bosnian government to turn these people over. and then immediately put them in Guantanamo and has held them there incommunicado for 6 long years. And I think it's significant that when the U.S. government makes a threat like that, we're going to pull out of the Dayton Peace Accord, we're going to let Bosnia go back into a civil war, and we're going to let the peace deal completely collapse, we're going to let the Bosnian government collapse unless you give us these 6 guys. That's an act of terrorism, I think.
Yeah, and evidence, we don't need no stinking evidence.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, and finally, airstrikes in Syria.
Yeah, what happens if an October surprise is launched and nobody is surprised? We had such a scenario this week. The United States forces in Iraq launched a cross-border strike into Syria that killed several people in Syria. The Syrian government says they were civilians, women and children. The U.S., of course, military, which has never been dishonest about these things in the past, said that they were terrorists. The ostensible purpose of this was that you haven't heard much about this in a while, the whole shibboleth of foreign fighters in Iraq being responsible for the insurgency. That's been pretty widely discredited, but that was trotted out this time again, saying that the foreign fighters that are coming to Iraq to help with al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia are coming through the Syrian border, and they've asked Syria to crack down on them, et cetera, et cetera. The Syrian-Iraqi border is basically open desert, and much of it is not guarded because it is such difficult terrain to traverse. But rather than trying to work the situation out, say, diplomatically, and we know we have diplomatic relations with Syria. How do we know this? Because we do extraordinary rendition of terror suspects to the Syrian prisons in order for them to be tortured.
Right.
So clearly there's a working relationship there.
There is some kind of working relationship
but not a good one. But rather than do that, we decided 8 days before an election to do an unprovoked strike into a sovereign country and see if, hey, maybe we can get lucky and they'll retaliate.
Yeah, and it's so cynical. I mean, the U.S. government spokespeople basically admitted outright that, oh, yeah, the Bush administration is doing this because they want to preserve the option of striking against terrorism suspects, not convicted terrorists, terrorism suspects on the soil of any country anywhere without first getting the okay of that country's government. We reserve the right to kill anybody anywhere at any time if we suspect them of doing something we don't like. And
that's called murder, isn't it?
Yeah, generally that's referred to as murder, or it might also be referred to as terrorism. But and they basically admitted that the Bush administration is doing that now because they want to preserve this option, and they are hoping that the next president will take it up as a valid option and keep it going.
Yeah, and various people in the Bush administration have been very explicit about saying that that's their goal, is to see that this the so-called Bush doctrine of preemptive strikes and the ability to kill anyone and anywhere at any time for any reason is preserved permanently. They're very attached to that.
All right. Then that takes us to this week's events.
Yeah. Well, the main event, of course, is the election on Tuesday. And if you want change, don't stop with the election, because we got 4 years between elections and an awful lot of work to be done. Elections themselves don't change things. People do. But elected offices are part of the process. So if you haven't voted already, and if you please do so on or by Tuesday. One interesting place to hang out, the weekly gathering of Drinking Liberally at Montlake Ale House is usually a huge gathering on election night. So if you're looking for some place to watch election parties that's not attached to a particular campaign headquarters, that may be a good place to hang out over in Montlake. But anyway, get out and vote early and vote often on Tuesday.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks with news and tips. Our editorial endorsements are online. Some people have had trouble finding them. That's because at this point they're in a previous issue. You go to back issues at www.eatthestate.org, click on the October 9th issue, and it'll come right up, election 08, tragedy or farce. But if you have trouble finding it, email us us at editorial@eatthestate.org, and we'll be happy to send you the link. But you can also find the print version of Eat the State at coffee shops, web cafes, King County Library System, places like that around town. And again, if you have comments, tips, feedback, want those election results or recommendations, rather, or the results, because, well, quite frankly, we've rigged all the machines, then then drop us an email. Our email is editorial@eatthestate.org.